It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Women Inspiring Innovation Through Imagination, Celebrating Women in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics is the title of a talk given at the Community College of Allegheny County in Pittsburgh by Terry O'Neill, the national president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. She joins us now in Studio A to talk about the contributions of women in those fields and the challenges women and girls still face. Terry O'Neill, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much.
Why do so few women pursue math and science jobs?
I think that's the central question. It's the most important question I think that we need to answer. And it really is puzzling when you consider that, in fact, for both men and women, there is a STEM wage premium. But for women, the wage premium is actually quite a bit higher than it is even for men. So men's wage premium is something like 23 to 25% if they're in a STEM field, science, technology, engineering, or math. Their wage is likely to be almost 25% higher than if they're not. For women, it's 33%. 33% bump up in pay if you go into a STEM field. So why is it that we don't see more women in STEM? Here's some really bad statistics. Women are nearly half the workforce today. They constitute just a little less than one quarter of the STEM workforce. Those numbers are from, I think, 2009, 2010. In 2000, it was exactly the same. Women constituted only 24% of the STEM workforce in 2000. So we haven't gotten anywhere in 10 years. And so the question is why. I think that there are both internal reasons and external reasons. I think the external reasons are by far the most important and the most determinative. So, for example, an internal reason is women and girls just don't have that much interest in STEM fields. Well, how much interest do we really think that women and girls are going to have in a field where they know they're not welcome? How much interest can a young woman college student gin up in a field where she's told and believes that she won't have family-friendly policies if she goes into this field? So I think what we have to do is look at the external forces, the gender stereotyping that says that women really aren't suited for this kind of work, which is still pervasive in this country. The family unfriendly policies that you see that tend to be worse in the STEM fields than in non-STEM fields. And I think the other problem that because here's the sort of self-perpetuating circle that you get into. Because there are so few women in STEM fields, there are very few women mentors. And so that means that there will be few women in STEM. So kind of there's not very many women there because there's not many women there.
So you're saying that there's still this glass ceiling in place preventing women from reaching their full potential, particularly in this field?
Very definitely.
What then can schools do better to support women and girls in these areas?
Honestly, mentoring programs are extremely important. Problem solving, you know, a lot of STEM is really problem solving, particularly when you move into research and then into innovation and development of products. It seems to me that the kinds of products that universities and colleges can be encouraging STEM students to look at would be problem solving things that women care about, things that would make women's lives easier. There's an awful lot of potential out there. I think that in a male-dominated field, certain questions just don't occur to the folks who are making the decisions.
And what should educators and policymakers consider for the future? What things realistically can be put in place?
Oh, I think that self-conscious policies, I think goals can be put in place. I think that a college that is not producing as many women in the STEM field as men needs to question itself and begin understanding why that college is not producing graduates. So ask the question differently, right? Because right now the question that's being asked is, gosh, why aren't those girls and women pursuing these careers? I think the right question to ask is, what are we doing wrong that we're not producing women graduates? If you ask the question that way, you'll start getting better results.
Programs like WISE, which stands for Women in Science and Engineering, have popped up at universities and high schools all over the nation. What can you say about the inroads that have been made in the last generation?
You know, I think in the last generation, the inroads have been very, very good. There are some, not enough, but some real role models for women and girls that come to mind. Mae Jemison, for example, and Sally Ride, for example, that girls can look at as youngsters and say, geez, I might want to do that when I grow up.
And Sally Ride, the astronaut.
The astronaut. And Mae Jemison, the first astronaut.
Right.
The first women astronaut engineer, right? There are some role models. I think right now what we need to focus on is I think of it as more of a grassroots pursuit. And the reason I say that is that while big stars are important and role models, I think what we need to do is be on the ground. Teachers need to be encouraging girls and young women to move into these fields. And I think that's probably going to get us where we need to go better than just relying on the few people who make it and, you know, make it big. And, gee, maybe that would be a draw. I think the other thing that we really should look at is my sense is that I think some women experience hostility in the STEM field. But I don't think that most men want to make those fields hostile. I think that while educational institutions in particular can encourage girls and women to think about these fields, they can also encourage boys and men to be open to more women and girls coming into that space. I think that boys and men are very open to that kind of encouragement, and that is something that should be paid attention to. Because again, if the perception of the girl is that this classroom is only for boys, this is not a classroom where boys are going to respect me or treat me as an equal or want me there. That is a perception, and maybe she's wrong and maybe she's right, but certainly we need to make sure that the boy's attitude is welcoming and respectful.
As far as the role models that you mentioned, and when you talk about somebody like Sally Ride, she's a household name. Anybody that follows the space program knows who she is, and she is a star because she was an astronaut and the first female to go in space. Or American female. Does it necessarily have to be someone like that that women need to look at and aspire to, especially when you have so many women now working at Mission Control, for example, with NASA, women who are working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, including some CMU grads who are involved with the Mars rover? As we see women making inroads behind the scenes, maybe not in some of the glamour roles, is that inspiring to women?
That's what I think. I think that it would be very nice to be able to point to these women who really are making a difference and participating in that as to be the inspiring role model. I think that's exactly right.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. My guest is Terry O'Neill, National President of NOW, the National Organization for Women, who is in Pittsburgh to speak at the Community College of Allegheny County. One of the things that we traditionally associate with the NOW organization is the push for the Equal Rights Amendment. I can remember back in the 70s when that was a big push, and it was a hot topic of conversation, and many people were following what was going on in that fight. We don't hear as much about it anymore, but apparently that fight has not ended. Tell us a little bit about what is happening with ERA or the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, the fight has not ended at all. Currently, there's actually been a new strategy developed over the past decade or so. We call it the three-state strategy. And the idea is that although by its own terms, the Equal Rights Amendment that was passed out of Congress in 1972, by its terms had a deadline, ultimately a deadline of 1982, the thinking now is that deadline actually was not legitimate. And by 1982, there were 35 states that had ratified the amendment. So the argument that is being put forth now is that all we need is three more states, 38 states needed to ratify an amendment. We've got 35. All we need is three more. And then the amendment would be ratified. And let me just say, it's really interesting to me. The ERA is absolutely essential still. We need to have women's rights in the Constitution.
Why do we need that? And to many people, I'm sure there's an obvious answer. But the ERA, when the first initial well-covered push was happening, you're going back almost 40 years,
right?
And people think, well, geez, 40 years later, we're seeing so many more women in positions of power in the workplace. So why would we need an equal rights amendment in 2013?
Right, exactly. It's very interesting. I think the main reason we need is we have at least one Supreme Court justice who goes around the country and is very proudly pronouncing that the 14th Amendment does not include women. And let me just quote the 14th Amendment for a moment. It says, "Nor shall any person be deprived of the equal protection of the laws." And Justice Antonin Scalia has repeatedly said publicly that person does not include women. And he says that because he relies on legislative history of the 14th Amendment. It's a poor argument. It's a very bad argument. I consider myself to be a person. But Justice Scalia does not, for constitutional equality purposes, consider women to be persons. If we had a constitutional amendment that said, you know, equality of rights under the law shall not be abridged on the basis of sex, that would be clear to even to Justice Scalia.
So the ERA would clarify, or in essence, rewrite the law.
Absolutely.
To include that provision.
Specifically to include that provision. The interesting thing to me is that, in fact, since the 1970s, this country has undergone a deep sea change. And I believe it's irrevocable. And the most interesting thing to me is that it was really not until the 1990s or maybe the late 90s and early 2000s that polling started showing that the vast majority of men and women say, yes, women should have equality when asked. You start seeing a gender gap when you then ask the next question, which is, do you think women do have equality? And more men say, yes, they do, than women say we do. So there's a bit of a gap there, but there's very little gap between men and women on the question of whether women should have equality. So not only I think is ERA necessary, I think that the reason the idea of a three-state strategy is gaining traction is precisely because the world has changed and that men are with us right now and believe that women should be in the Constitution. So I think we have a much better shot at getting it in the future than we did 40 years ago.
How would the ratification or passage of the ERA impact equal pay for equal work? We've talked about that. That's been a topic on this program in the past. Women are still not paid the same as men, which may be why some women don't pursue math and science jobs. So what about how the ERA would impact that? And what about the impact of that lack of equity in dissuading women, young women, from pursuing jobs in the science and math field?
You know, the ERA, for one thing, would provide the constitutional basis for legislation requiring employers to take a look at their pay scale and their sort of the architecture of how they pay their employees and figure out why their own women employees are systematically paid less. So, for example, it seems to me that it would be fair for if an employer's workforce shows skewed wages, that the women generally are paid less than the men, then I think it's incumbent we should have a law, and an ERA would support a law that would require employers to justify the difference. And if you scratch the surface a little bit, what you'll find is that workplaces in this country are severely sex segregated and that men, the work that is done by the men is paid more simply because that's what happens in a segregated society. You have first-class citizens and second-class citizens. And when it's sex-segregated, the women turn out to be the the second-class citizens. So the Equal Rights Amendment would certainly provide a constitutional basis for legislation, for regulation, for demands that that businesses start really paying women what we're worth.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. We're talking with Terry O'Neill, National President of NOW, the National Organization for Women. Again, she's in Pittsburgh speaking at the Community College of Allegheny County. NOW is certainly an organization that is very much involved in the political battles of the day. Earlier this month, NOW called upon leaders in the United States to reject the austerity model that, in the words of the organization, has been, quote, economically devastating to our sisters in Europe, end quote. What specifically do you want the U.S. to do?
I want the U.S. to engage in a massive, aggressive jobs program. If you the vast majority of people in this country obviously care about the federal budget deficit, but they want the deficit to be closed by job creation. So here's how it works. Right now, the United States can borrow money at 0% interest. That's pretty darn good. Borrow a ton of money, put people back to work. The schools are crumbling. Our physical infrastructure is crumbling. The nurses and the teachers and the child care workers that have been laid off at the federal, at the state and county level is just jaw-dropping. Put people back to work. What will happen then is a couple of things. First of all, employed people are consumers. They'll start buying things, and private business will then be able finally to pick up and start employing people. And the other thing is that employees are also taxpayers. So the income tax will then be going into the federal treasury, and that is the basis for beginning to bring down the deficit over time. The right wing has already admitted that there is no debt crisis in this country. In fact, what ideologues are trying to do in Washington, D.C. is claim that there is a crisis and use the claim of crisis to enact an ideologically driven insistence on cutting programs, social welfare programs. These are programs that disproportionately serve women. You're talking after-school programs, Head Start, family planning clinics, job training programs, nutrition programs. They all disproportionately serve women, but when you think about it, these are programs that also disproportionately employ women. Your child care workers, home health care workers, teachers, nurses. So this attack on social welfare programs for the purpose of funding expanded military, expanded weapons purchases, and tax breaks for billionaires and corporations is very disproportionately basically transferring money from families that from women and their families, right, to the wealthy who don't really need that kind of transfer. So instead of austerity, and we've seen in Europe what it's doing, it's huge fundamental problems in Europe, and Cyprus is just the tip of the iceberg right now. The austerity disproportionately harms women, does not help the country, puts nobody back to work. And the people of this country, in my view, want to do what we're saying should happen. Massive jobs program, put people back to work, close the deficit. And then when the private sector is actually humming along and causing full employment, that's when the federal government can stop the tax subsidies to the billionaires and corporations that we're currently subsidizing at ridiculous rates.
Next week, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments in two cases critical to advancing the cause of gay marriage in the United States. The NOW Foundation has joined other social justice organizations in filing three amicus briefs in these cases on behalf of same-sex marriage rights. Talk about the push that you're making, that NOW is making as an organization here.
So two of the briefs we signed on to argue basically the same legal point in both of the cases that the Supreme Court is hearing. It's Prop 8 in California, which amended the state constitution to prohibit same-sex marriage, and the challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act, which denies federal benefits to same-sex married couples. And in both of those cases, we have signed on to briefs that say that that refusing to recognize same-sex marriage is sex discrimination. that under the 14th Amendment, no person shall be denied the equal protection of the laws. Currently, despite Justice Scalia's preferences, that is recognized to prohibit sex-based discrimination. There has to be a really good reason to discriminate on the basis of sex under the 14th Amendment. And what we're arguing is that the sex of your partner should not be a reason to discriminate, that the government has that, so that it's not that an individual is being discriminated against on the basis of his or her own sex, but on the basis of the sex of his or her partner, which is just as much of a violation of equal protection of the laws as direct sex discrimination. The other case, the other argument that we're making is exclusively improbate. In California, the Proposition 8 amended the state constitution to prohibit same-sex marriage solely on religious grounds. If you look at all of the arguments made by the proponents of Prop 8, they were all religious arguments. And then if you look at who funded Proposition 8, it was all religious organizations, predominantly the Mormon Church and the Catholic Church. And so the argument that we're making is that it is really dangerous, specifically for women, it's dangerous to allow legislative enactments, whether it's done in a referendum, as in Prop 8, or done directly by a legislature, solely on religious grounds, that religious-based legislating that takes away fundamental rights, like in Prop 8's case, the right to marry. But we believe that if that's allowed to stand, the next fundamental right they'll go after is the right to choose an abortion, solely on religious grounds. And what we're saying is that that is a violation of the Constitution.
What do you say to the 68% of Republicans who say that legalizing gay marriage would undermine traditional family?
What I would say is that it lifts up and upholds loving families, the right to marry, the reason the right to marry is a fundamental right is that you can't legislate love, you can't legislate commitment, you can't legislate loyalty, and that our country is stronger when people who form loving, committed relationships have those relationships recognized and respected by the entire community. Because what happens within those loving and committed relationships is that people are supported and families are stronger and the community then gets stronger. So I guess I'm not clear on what is meant by the phrase traditional family, but I think that loving families are the ones we want to promote.
Terry O'Neill is the national president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, joining us in Studio A. Thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Up next, travel correspondent Elaine LaBalme on traveling solo when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.